Okay, if you have a Bible, turn to the book of Exodus. We're continuing our series in the book of Exodus. If you're not familiar with the Bible, there should be one under one of the seats near you. And the book of Exodus is the second book of the Bible, Genesis and then Exodus. And we're going to look this morning at a very familiar story. If you've been part of the church, this is probably a story that goes all the way back to when you were a real little kid. You know, I'm going to mark my days, you know, with flannel boards and stuff like that in Sunday school class, learning this story. But my hope and prayer is that God would speak afresh to us, even through this story that may be so familiar to so many of us. As we look around, and you can't help but notice just the brokenness of our world as we see what is going on today. And I don't know if you're like me. I assume in many ways we want to be quickly freed from all of these things that hit us, especially the negative stuff, right? We pray and we long for a solution that comes really, really quickly. And whether that's in an area of looking for justice in this world, or it may be a financial struggle that's come due to this COVID crisis, it may be a bad diagnosis that you've gotten from a doctor, it may be a relational conflict you're in, it may be a problem with your kids, if your kids, it may be a problem with your parents. Anyhow, as we look around at life, there are a lot of problems, and we recognize sometimes more than others that we're in a really broken world. And we just long for God to come in and just fix it. One of my favorite modern authors, a guy named John Ortberg, said this: God is never in a hurry. It's one of his most irritating qualities. And I think most of us feel that at times, right? We want God to step in. And as believers, we trust and believe that God could step in and work instantaneously to solve these problems. And sometimes, if you've walked with the Lord long enough, in God's grace and in his mercy, he does show up almost instantaneously and he answers those prayers. And it's like, yes, thank you, Lord. You know, we've prayed for people that have had bad diagnoses and they've gone back to the doctor and then this is not showing up anymore on the x-ray. We don't know what happened. And that's wonderful. It's phenomenal. Or you're in a financial strait and all of a sudden a letter shows up in the mailbox with a check in there. And it's just like, God, I don't know how you knew the timing of this, but you just worked perfectly. And those are wonderful experiences. But in my experience and in talking to most Christians, God doesn't usually free us instantly from the difficulty that we're in. But he frees us as we walk through the difficulty, in the midst of the difficulty, often working a lot more slowly from our perspective than we're happy with, right? And the challenge is, as we walk through those times where we feel that God is silent, the struggle and the temptation is to fear that God is absent in the midst of those times of silence. We talked last week about the first couple chapters of this book of Exodus, that God is not really mentioned until the end of chapter 2 in any prominent way. And I think Moses, the author, is saying something by that. He's saying there's sometimes that it just doesn't seem that we see God at work in ways that are really real and tangible, and it seems like circumstances may be going from bad to worse, and we see glimmers of hope. We saw that with the midwives last week, that God blessed because of their faithfulness to him, and they're willing to trust him despite the Pharaoh's orders. But it's sometimes a real struggle in the midst of that. And we left off at the end of chapter 1 last week, Pharaoh commanding all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. So here is probably the most powerful man in the world, at least that part of the world at that time, saying basically, we are legalizing genocide for these people. We want to eliminate these people, and the way we're going to eliminate these people is slowly by eliminating the males. And so that's kind of where we left off at the end of chapter 1. And I'm going to read this again. This is a super familiar story, but then I want to talk a little bit about it. We mentioned last week that in 1 Corinthians 10, Paul says that the stuff that's written in the Old Testament is written as examples for us. Another way that word example means a type, is an archetype, is an example of how God deals with his people and how sometimes as a bad example, things we shouldn't do, but also things that we should do. So I think as we look at this, these things, to know they're written so that we get some benefit out of it. It's just not stories that occurred a couple thousand years ago, but this is something God wants to use to communicate to our hearts about his nature and how we should respond to him and how he responds to his people sometimes in the midst of difficulty. So we'll pick up in chapter 2, starting in verse 1. Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. Wow. If you're a Jew, there's a glimmer of hope here. The tribe of Levi, you know, it's the tribe of what? The priests, of those that are mediators between God and man. And he says, okay, at the beginning, there's a man and a woman, and they come together, and they're both Levites. So there's a glimmer of hope in the midst of this darkness that's going on. The woman conceived and bore a son. Uh-oh. We just read that decree. What's going to go on? And when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. That word fine there is literally the Hebrew word tov. It means good. It's all the way back to the garden, the tree of the knowledge of tov and ra, of good and evil. So this is a good boy. Some translations translate it basically a handsome child. I think there's more going on than that. I don't think that Moses' mother, Jochebed, is going to say, well, not that good looking a kid. We're just going to toss him in the river, basically. But this idea that this child was good, that he was created in the image of God. And in Hebrews, in chapter 11, it says that this couple were people of faith, that despite the decree to kill this child, they were people of faith, that we're not going to destroy this child. This child is good. And Stephen's speech in Acts 7, he says it was no ordinary child. So there was something about this child that marked him. And we're not exactly sure what that is. It may be just been a sense given by the Spirit to these parents that this is a special child. And so they, despite risk to themselves, they kept the child. They did not throw this child into the river. Verse 3, when she could hide him no longer. Those of you who've had babies, you know, they can be fairly loud. And as they age, they get louder, right? They have more vocal strength. And so it's getting more dicey. And when she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. Interesting. She took for him a basket made of bulrushes. Literally, this is the word ark. The only other time this is used is back of Noah's ark. And Noah coated the ark with pitch. And here we have the mother of Moses coating this little ark with pitch. And so I think the author is pulling us back and saying, oh, you know, Noah was the deliverer through the ark. And maybe there's a connection here. Is this child going to be the deliverer? And so she coats it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it along the reeds by the riverbank. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Notice, no guarantees. We're not aware here that the Lord had told mom and dad, okay, I want you to make this little reed boat and put it into the river there. It's just, okay, this is what's right to do. We can't hide this child any longer. You know, we're not living in a 3,500 square foot house and where we've got a closet we can soundproof. So when the Egyptian guards come in, we could say, no kids here. You know, do you hear anything? No. It's like, okay, you're in this little probably mud, you know, not a great place to live. If you've got a child in there, it's going to be known. It's like, okay, we're living in a river community. Where can we hide this child? Probably the best place is among the reeds at the side. And so they put this boy there, and mom says, okay, sis, this is Miriam, you watch. And so Miriam is there standing at a distance to know what would be done to him. Just take a pause there for a moment and imagine Moses' mom's heart at this point in time. This is a child that she's loved, that she's cared for, that she's nursed for 3 months. And there's an amazing bond that occurs between a mom and a child, right? And then here she realizes, okay, this child is in danger. If we keep him in the house, it's obvious the Egyptians are going to find out about this, and they're going to take this child and throw him in the river. So I've got to do something. So we're going to put him here, and I'm going to station Miriam there to watch and see what happens. Verse 4, and his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came to bathe in the river. Uh-oh. This is the daughter of the Pharaoh that said, okay, every Egyptian that finds a Hebrew boy, toss him in the river. This child is already really near the river. In fact, in the river. What is this daughter of Pharaoh going to do to this Hebrew child? She comes down to bathe at the river. While her young woman walked beside the river, she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. What are we going to do here? She took pity on him. She had compassion, very much unlike her father, and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. She recognized this was a Hebrew child. We don't know exactly how that was. It may have been the clothing that the child was wrapped in. It may have been, well, who else is going to place their child in a basket in the river? Probably not an Egyptian, but they knew this was a Hebrew child, and she knew the order of her father. So despite that, she had pity on this child. This is one of the Hebrews' children. Then his sister, Miriam, we don't know how long this transpired, but she just comes walking by. Oh, so you found a boy there. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go call a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you? Hey, the child's pretty young and needs to be nursed still, you know. I know you probably haven't any kids you can't nurse right now. You know, do you want me to find a nurse that could help you out with this? And Pharaoh's daughter, verse 8, said to her, go. So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages. So the woman took the child and nursed him. When the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses because she said, I drew him out of the water. So here we have a story where God's name is not mentioned at all. Yet God's fingerprints are all over this. Even when we feel God is being silent, that does not end his sovereignty and his direction of our lives. And you can see how he's working in the midst of this. 2 Levites are married, a really good sign for especially the future deliverer that is going to be kind of this priest, the ultimate priest till Christ comes, that mediates this covenant between God and his people at this point in time. The child was good. And the one person that probably should have been threatened by this child, a member of Pharaoh's own family, is the one that shows compassion on this child. There's no indication in the text here that God had told Moses' mom and his sister, okay, this is the plan, this is what I want you to do. So often in life, I think we're going through and we want God to show up and assign, what do I need to do? And we want, okay, this is exactly the way you need to go, and it's written in the heavens, and I can't make any mistakes in the way that I go. But I think often God says, okay, I've given you a mind. You know the truth of the word. Make decisions in light of that. And I don't get the sense that this was just, we'll just throw them in the river, and we'll see what happens. I'm thinking, okay, you know, there may have been an indication that Pharaoh's daughter was a little bit more tender than Pharaoh. And they may have known, okay, this is where she goes to bathe. And say, okay, how can we figure this out? So we don't know how much planning went into this, but the reality is, just because we believe in God's sovereignty doesn't mean we sit back and do nothing. They did what they could. And God working behind the scenes showed up in a very powerful way. To me, this should give us a lot of confidence that God is at work, despite sometimes our feeling that we can't hear exactly what he's going to do. He's still sovereign. He's still in control. He's still on the throne. Can I just, you know, mom and sis just waiting there, you know, imagine the tension as, you know, this child is, baskets opened up and Pharaoh's daughter looks in there. What's she going to do? And God showed up. To me, one of the prayers that astounds me and also frustrates me, and we talked about it in Colossians when we were going through that book, is Colossians 1:12. This is what Paul prays. May you be strengthened with all power, according to his glorious might. Okay, strengthened with all power according to his glorious might. Okay, this is the God that's created the universe with a word, right? And in all its immensity. So Paul's praying, I want you to be strengthened with all power according to his glorious might. All right, and you're thinking, okay, something simply amazing is going to happen. For, and then he gives the reason, for all endurance and patience. I don't know about you, but I really like, oh, really? I don't want to be strengthened for endurance and patience. I want to be strengthened to conquer. I want to be strengthened to go up to Pharaoh and say, dude, you're going down, and I want him to drop dead on the spot and the people to leave the country. I don't want to have to wait 80 years. That's the time it's going to take for this child to grow and ultimately deliver the people. I want him to show up now, but God says, I'm going to work in the midst of these circumstances. So hang on to me in the midst of the trouble. I'm not taking all the trouble away, but you know what, believer? I'm going to give you the strength to be able to endure this. And sometimes that strength needs to be massive and mighty for you to keep on keeping on. You ever been at that place where you're just like, Lord, where in the world are you? I don't think I can bear one more weight. And then all of a sudden, poof, something else hits. And you're like, Lord, what in the world are you doing? Why don't you show up? Why don't you remedy this situation? And he's like, just depend on me in the midst of this. I will work this out. But often, God's timetable is a whole lot different than ours. My wife and I were reading Psalm 27 the other morning, and it ends like this. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord. If you read down in this chapter in verse 23, during those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. This is many days that this is going on. Yet God says, I'm going to be with you in the midst of those many days. I'm working out my plan, and it's not going to be as quick probably as you want it to be, but trust me, I'm at work. We look around at the world. We see this COVID-19 virus hitting. We see kind of the endemic racism and injustice and brutality that's going on, and we just can wonder, where is God? And I'm sure the Hebrews were wondering that in the midst of all this as well. In Genesis, I think 6:20, it tells us that Moses' dad lived to be 137. So if they had Moses, you know, probably, you know, late teens, early 20s, in that range, he would have been alive to be delivered by his son out of this land. But it was a whole lot of waiting, a whole lot of waiting. Yet, in one sense, the Hebrews should have known that, right? The promise to Abraham all the way back in Genesis 15, that he told them, you know what, you're going to be sojourners in a land that you are foreigners there for 400 years. And likewise, God gives us clues and warnings as well. In this world, you will have trouble, but take heart, I've overcome the world. He who is in you is greater than he who is in this world. Though this whole world lies in the hands of the evil one, your faith is what overcomes this world. And there's all these promises to us. So my encouragement to you is to continue to act righteously and wisely in the midst of a very broken, often very evil world. Stand for truth. Stand up for Christ in the midst of all of this. And to me, one of the things that helps, and this is kind of my second point. The first is that God's at work despite what we feel is his silence. And the second is God delights in using what was meant for evil to serve his good purposes for his people. We saw a foreshadowing of this in Joseph's life in Genesis 50:20, where dad dies, Jacob dies. The brothers had already, you know, been in Egypt, and now it's like, oh man, dad's dead. Joseph's going to get revenge now. So they come groveling to him and said, oh, dad said when he was still alive not to treat us badly. And Joseph was kind of wounded by that. You think, what kind of a person do you think I am? And then he says, you meant it for evil when you sold me into slavery. This was no good intent in that. But he said, God meant it for good, for the salvation of many people, including my own family that came down to Egypt and the whole experience there. You look at this, and the evil decree of Pharaoh to throw boys into the river to their death, the very instrument of what was supposed to be the death of these boys becomes the instrument of raising up the deliverer of his people. Isn't that amazing? As you look at this, you see something else later on happening, right? That Christ, the very instrument of death, the cross, becomes the means of his deliverance of us. He used what was evil and he turned it on its head and flipped it around and turned it into what was good. To me, that's the ultimate irony, that through death, Christ defeated death. And here we have a foreshadowing of that. In essence, Moses' mom receives this boy back from the dead. She didn't know what was going to happen. She knew if she kept him at home, he was going to die. And so she just, in essence, gave him to the Lord and his sovereignty and said, deal with this child, please. I'm sure her pleas were intense. And then an amazing, and I think God's got a sense of humor. It's like, okay, you get him back. And not only do you get him back, but I'm going to have Pharaoh's daughter pay you for what you were going to do before. It's like, this is, I think it's just a sense of humor. I got to say, look at this. I'm going to bless you. And not only are you going to get your child back, but you're going to be paid and you're going to live well because of it. As we look at this, it's just, to me, an amazing way that God tends to turn things around. And out of circumstances that seem so evil and so wrong, he brings something beautiful. He brings this child. I'm going to give you a little apologetics aside right now, because a lot of, if you get on the internet and you'll search this story, it'll say, well, obviously, this was borrowed from the Sargon birth legend. And, you know, you can't trust the Bible, yada, yada, yada. And there's all sorts of internet stuff about this. And it's very true that in ancient history, there was a lot of these abandoned child kind of stories that were going on, that a child was abandoned at birth because of some circumstances. Usually the child was unwanted, or the child was the product of a rape of a god and a human being and just wanted to be dealt with. And as you look at these stories, Sargon was an Assyrian king that lived 23rd, 24th century BC. And there was a legend that grew up around him that he was placed in a basket on a river, and somebody found him later, picked him up, raised him, and he became the great Sargon in history. And so people will look at that, and you'll get online and say, oh yeah, this is just borrowing from that motif that it's a total scam. And it sounds convincing. You know, Sargon, he lived a lot before this. And even if you take a late date, this is kind of 1446, around that. Moses 80 years old, so this is early 1500s BC. And so Sargon was there, and it's like, oh yeah, that probably makes a lot of sense. They did copy. The problem is that all this is anecdotal, and it's on the internet, so that should give you your first clue. There's a guy named Brian Lewis that did a PhD at New York University, not a Christian school, trying to, you know, defend the Bible. But the reality is, yes, Sargon lived in the 23rd, 24th century BC, but the legend of Sargon's birth probably did not occur at that point in time. And this is a PhD dissertation, so it would have been subject to a lot of scrutiny. It's about 400 pages long. Anyhow, this is on page 183. He says this: it may in fact be impossible to establish with any certainty the origins of the Sargon legend based on the available evidence. The text lacks any obvious grammatical, lexicographical, philological features which would allow a precise dating. And then he goes on later to talk, there's evidence for the like an older date of this legend and a later date. It seems like the later date is stronger. And he says there's three idiomatic expressions which occur in the legend that are attested only at the end of the second millennium. That's going to be around 1,000, 1,100 BC and in the Neo-Assyrian period. That's going to be like 600 to 1,000 BC. This provides the strongest evidence available that the Sargon legend was composed in its present form at a much later date than previously thought. So again, if you're doing research on this stuff, don't just listen to one guy with a YouTube channel that is telling this is all a bunch of junk. Look for solid scholarship. This is a guy that's got a PhD in Akkadian languages. Don't ask me why you would want to get a PhD in Akkadian languages, but he got one for this. But the reality is he's saying, okay, yeah, Sargon historically lived at this point in time. We don't really have a clue when this legend was written. In fact, there's evidence that it may have been written in the 600 to 1000 BC period, which would have been after the events of Moses as well. So again, just recognize that there are people out there that want to attack scripture. So look for solid academic credentials behind this stuff, not just somebody that pops up a channel and says, oh yeah, obviously Sargon's older than this guy, so this is just a whole bunch of hooey that some Hebrew author made up past the fact. Okay, that's enough of that, but just beware. And so you see God turning on their head all these decrees that Pharaoh was issuing to get rid of the Hebrews. And I think you see in this also that God delights to use the weak to humble the powerful. Pharaoh, we saw him in chapter 1, got together with his advisors, and they were shrewdly crafting these plans to eliminate the Hebrew threat that they felt. We know this guy's evil, basically, because he doesn't care what lengths he needs to go to eliminate these people. He's going to do it. And so first, okay, we're going to work these people to the bone. That doesn't work. They multiply, right? Okay, we're going to tell the midwives, kill those babies. That doesn't work, right? So now we're going to tell the Egyptians to throw the Hebrew boys into the river. And we see here, that doesn't work as well. In all of these stories, who foiled Pharaoh's plans? Women. Five women in these first two chapters foil the plans of Pharaoh, the most powerful man in the world, and his government at that time probably made up of all male advisors. You have the two Hebrew midwives, probably not much social standing even in their own culture, because usually midwives could not have their own children. Then you have Moses' mom and Moses' sister. And then in the end, Pharaoh's own daughter that foils his plans. I just love that. God is raising up his deliverer despite all the decrees of the most powerful man in the world to put down these people. God has not forgotten his people, even though they were in difficulty. And he's working behind the scenes to raise up a deliverer. In Acts 7:22, Stephen in his speech says this: Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. He was powerful in speech and action. We're not told how long Moses was with his mom. It's just when he basically grew, and we're not told when that was. But it's clear later on that Moses had a sense of identity and solidarity with the Hebrew people. So there was time enough for his mom to, and dad probably, to impart into him, this is who we are, Moses. These are the circumstances of why you're in Pharaoh's household right now. This is how God worked. And I wonder what he's going to do with your life. I hope it's great things. And you sense in Moses this rising up of this sense of justice when the Hebrew slaves were being mistreated by the Egyptians, so much so that he kills that Egyptian taskmaster later on. He was passionate for justice, but did it in the wrong way. But I just look at this and say, how brilliant of God. Okay, here is Moses who's going to be interacting with the highest powers in Egyptian circles later on. And God has him raised right in that household. He's going to know all the wisdom of these Egyptians. He's going to know how they think. He's going to know how they act. He's going to know them in the midst of all of this. God preparing him. Also, with all this learning, he's preparing him, I think, to be the one that writes most of the Torah. He's educated. He's literate. He's able to do all those things he probably couldn't do if he was just a slave at that point in time. So Moses not only is protected from death, but he's protected from the rigors of really abusive slavery to be raised in Pharaoh's household. God is working behind the scenes in unexpected ways. And so to me, that gives me hope in the midst of this world. And you're like, oh God, I want you to raise up a ruler that will conquer all this and deal. It's like, yeah, I am at work, but probably it's going to be in a way that you don't even recognize. Through the people that don't have much status or power or authority. In the book of 1 Corinthians, don't turn there. I'll just read this. Chapter 1. Paul says this. For consider your calling, brothers and sisters. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. And because of him, you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God, righteousness, sanctification, and redemption. So it is written, let him who boasts, boast in the Lord. When it's all said and done in this story, it's going to be God that gets the glory. Yes, he used Moses to deliver the people, but he was the one that was delivering the people. And as we talked about last week in the book of Luke in chapter 9, after the transfiguration, or during the transfiguration, when Moses and Elijah are talking with Jesus, they were speaking to Jesus about his exodus that would soon take place in Jerusalem. So we know that Jesus is thinking in these terms about his deliverance of his people from the slavery to sin and to death. So I love these books and how God connects all of these together and the types that we see here fulfilled in Jesus Christ in his exodus. We're going to celebrate communion this morning, where we remember what Jesus Christ has done for us. The people of Israel could not deliver themselves out of Egypt. That's going to be evident. It's going to take the work of God and a deliverer that God raises up. And likewise, we couldn't deliver ourselves from the enslavement to sin that all of us had in our lives. But God sent a second and greater Moses, Jesus Christ, to be our deliverer. And he turned what was probably the most horrendous object of death in that world, the most evil thing imaginable, into the instrument that brought us life and hope as he conquered death.